From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Henry Kissinger, we all know by now, will head the commission investigating American intelligence failures in connection with 9/11. The media response has been muted, partly because of the holiday timing, but also because of Kissinger's peculiar position as a public figure. MSNBC News anchor Brian Williams.
Look, there are a goodly number of Americans who spend each day in this country believing Henry Kissinger is an unindicted war criminal.
We spoke to Williams last year after the U.S. press failed to report that Kissinger had been subpoenaed by a French judge in connection with a South American terror network.
Should Henry Kissinger answer for either perceived past sins or reasons why his name may be in the news today? Yes. I think everyone needs to understand, though, there's a time and place for everything.
Now Kissinger is back in the news, and commentators ranging from William Sapphire of the New York Times to Stephen Colbert of Comedy Central's Daily Show have noted that Kissinger's unusual background makes him the man for the job.
If you want to investigate an assault on a democracy, who better to head it than the man who instigated the overthrow and assassination of the democratically elected leader of Chile in 1973? Who better to look into a secret attack than the man who secretly bombed Cambodia? And in general, who better to investigate the failures of U.S. intelligence on behalf of the American people than the man who successfully kept the American people completely in the dark about U.S. intelligence? Plus, he had sex with Shirley MacLaine.
He's always been criticized, to no avail. I mean, it isn't as if the criticism has stopped him.
Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen.
He went from success to success to success, much to the annoyance of his critics. I think after a while, people sort of tune it out.
Scott Armstrong, author and founder of the National Security Archive, says that given the nature of Kissinger's new job, with his mixed record in foreign and U.S. intelligence, and his current work as consultant to unspecified foreign governments and multinational corporations, investigative journalists should have come up with something new. But Armstrong has yet to see it.
There have always been critics of Henry Kissinger. People ought to be out there reporting on it, reporting about what's in his interest, how does he relate to these events. There has not been a lot of digging. I mean, who are his clients? He says he'll resign his clients if it's appropriate. Well, we need to know who the clients are if he's going to continue in that role. They include banks, energy companies, people that are involved in selling airframes and arms and so forth, international interests in which the Saudis and the Persian Gulf and the oil-dealing countries are right at the center of their activities. When you see investigative reporting that says here are who his clients are, here's what he's said in the past, here's how his record compares to these events, you know, that would be more in-depth than what we've seen. What we've seen is a litany of reasons why Henry Kissinger's not a good person in the view of a lot of people, but not really applied to this particular case.
Christopher Hitchens suggested that the reason there has been so little specific inquiry into Kissinger's past that would disqualify him for this gig is that he has cultivated a relationship with certain celebrity journalists like Ted Koppel, for example, that makes him kind of unassailable.
Henry Kissinger clearly has a relationship with some of the most important establishment people. I mean, he's the darling of a certain elite. He's the person who brings gravitas to the policy arguments that people like to have. And there are players, senior players in the journalistic community that eat that up, that see him socially, that I think are somewhat compromised from criticizing him. But journalism is an egalitarian game, and anybody that does their homework and anybody that digs up new facts can get a story in here that will cause an examination or a re-examination. The question is, who's going to re-examine it? The president gets to appoint it, and it's going to take a considerable outcry that's going to have to be picked up in Congress before it's going to make any difference.
Now, Congress isn't in session. Had Congress been here and there had been complaints flying from the Democratic side of the aisle, or better still, from the Republican side of the aisle, do you think this might have been a bigger story?
The president of the United States announced this on Thanksgiving Eve for a reason. There was nobody in town. It was impossible to get anybody. And as a result, he avoided a whole kind of round of criticism. So if Democrats had raised that question, if you had responsible actors posing questions and then have the administration have to respond to those questions, not because the press is asking them, but because the minority leader is asking them, or because somebody with an important committee in Congress is asking them, even Republicans have raised questions about it, then you would have had a dialogue that I think might have gotten them to say, well, maybe it shouldn't be Henry Kissinger. But it flew through because it was quiet and it was winter skiing. It just went downhill.
Now, not everybody stayed at the dinner table. Some people got up to write pieces.
Well, I think that, you know, the usual cast of characters that have things to say about Henry Kissinger did a pretty good job of reminding us all of the problems that Henry Kissinger's encountered in his life. There were some interesting things, too, because there were people on the right, some conservatives, who raised questions about, is this the right way to resolve this? The one that we kind of expected would be more critical was William Safire, who has a relationship with Kissinger, is not a Kissinger admirer in all instances, but basically adopted this very odd, it takes a thief to catch a thief, position. The problem with commentary was people were not quoting other figures of integrity with their own gravitas and standing, saying, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense to me. There really wasn't the resonance that's usually given in Washington when a story comes up. The press plays off against people who are able to say something that requires a response then from the administration.
In other words, if someone had gone to John Dean to get the "you have got to be kidding" quotation, they might have been doing a public service.
Yes, but, you know, it's the people that were around during Watergate. Dan Inouye, a senator from Hawaii, you know, I didn't see him quoted anywhere. People who had been involved in the energy investigations and the investigations of the Ron Rescue Mission that are around. I think Carl Levin was around during that period. John Glenn, who's just left Congress but is still around. Those were people that have institutional memories who would say, wait a minute, that's not the kind of person that can investigate the kind of things that they did. But we didn't have that. We didn't have people to play off.
All right. Scott Armstrong, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Scott Armstrong is a Washington-based journalist and founder of the National Security Archive. In the past several months, the New York Times has run more than 36 articles and several editorials about sex discrimination at the Augusta National Golf Club, home of the Masters Tournament. Two pieces that have not run were columns by Dave Anderson and Harvey Arriton, each in its way quibbling with the Times' editorial stance that superstar golfer Tiger Woods should boycott Augusta until women are admitted as members. Those columns were spiked by management because, according to a memo by managing editor Gerald Boyd, Arriton's column was insufficiently logical and Anderson's a case of intramural quarreling. But the stifling of dissenting voices has created an uproar of criticism, including that of our next guest, Alex Jones. He is director of the Jones Shorenstein Center for Media Studies at Harvard University, a former Times reporter, and the founding host of this show. Alex, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
Before I ask you to unload on the Times for me, would you play devil's advocate and tell me why there are times when a newspaper can legitimately limit the amount of debate on a given subject?
Well, I think that there are always good reasons for not putting something in a newspaper. I mean, there are reasons of taste. There are reasons of vulgarity. There are reasons of dishonesty or of just incompetence and lack of making your case persuasively with the information that supports what you're asserting. I mean, I believe in editing. Believe me, I do.
Okay, so what about the situation at the Times? Just good editing?
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is this. The way it was explained to me by people at the Times was that that these were not censured because of the perspective that they held, but because of the way they were executed. That's, you know, that's up to them. But I think that it's a hard sell because the appearance is very much like the case of the conflict of interest policy at the New York Times. I was at the New York Times for 9 years, and they had a very good and sophisticated policy about conflict of interest, which said that it was not enough that there was no conflict of interest. There could not be the appearance of a conflict of interest. And I think this sort of falls into the appearance of censorship, whether it is or not. And that, I think, is something that a news organization like the Times should stand against under all circumstances and certainly not want to be perceived that way.
In the Washington Post piece, you also acknowledged that it has long been at least unwritten policy at the Times for columnists not to quibble with the paper's stated editorial position.
Well, it's more complicated than that. It's not so much quibbling with the editorial position as attacking the Times or attacking their colleagues at the Times or the Times' coverage. I mean, I think that the New York Times policy was born when Bill Sapphire came there. Now, Bill Sapphire was hired as a columnist on the op-ed page because he did not agree with the editorial policies of the New York Times. And that's expected and that was wanted. But what he was told he could not do was to attack the New York Times directly or his colleagues. He had started doing something like that, and he stopped. But it was mostly on the basis of civility and collegiality that was there, not because of the ideas and the positions he took.
Do you believe that this controversy about the spiking of this column would have been the big deal that it has become had not the New York Times written so many stories in its news pages and editorialized so passionately on this subject?
I think that for the New York Times to spike a column on the basis of a conflict with Times editorial policy would have probably been a story regardless. I think, for instance, it could have been on any number of other issues that the Times has been strong about, in terms of its coverage. But I take your point that the fact that this is a very important story to the New York Times and that the columns that were spiked seem to be in defiance of that, that the slant in the sort of sympathies of the New York Times has made this something that has gotten a lot of attention, yes.
You talked about appearance of conflict, and the question is here, is this a case of we are on a crusade, and during the course of this crusade, we will brook no dissent
from within?
Well,
that is, the Times says not. I've worked with those people a long time. I think that this was a mistake in judgment, but I do not think, if you're suggesting that there is a party line at the New York Times and that no dissent will be tolerated in its news columns, I reject that idea. I think this was a mistake. I think it was a bad call, a mistake in judgment. But I do not accept the idea that the news coverage at the New York Times is cooked. I just don't look at it that way and don't believe it.
No smoking gun.
Not as far as I'm concerned. A mistake, though, and one that's getting a lot of attention, and I think that's not a bad thing.
All right, Alex. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
Alex Jones is the director of the Jones Shorenstein Center for Media Studies at Harvard University.
Coming up, a CNN producer scrutinizes his cinematic self in Live from Baghdad and why Michael Moore's anti-gun documentary is so off-target.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This Sunday marks the deadline for Iraq to present a thorough accounting of its programs for weapons of mass destruction. In a bit of TV serendipity, it's also the weekend HBO premieres a docudrama about the last war in Iraq called Live from Baghdad.
I've seen this panic before. Saigon, same thing. White House spooked the shit out of everybody. The reporters got in the helicopters and got the hell out. Robert, you know what I'm talking about. Of course they don't want us here. If we're here, the White House can't control the story. It goes to the world live. But I say we stay and report and prevail.
Okay, two things. First of all, remember where we are. We're within walking distance of the Iraqi parliament, the presidential palace, the Ministry of Defense, telecommunications centers. All of these are prime targets, everyone.
The film stars Michael Keaton as CNN News producer Robert Wiener and Helena Bonham Carter as his producer partner Ingrid Formanak. It tells the story of how CNN managed to be the only news crew transmitting to the U.S. the first night Operation Desert Storm sent bombs raining down on Baghdad. Americans were able to hear it live from reporters Bernard Shaw, John Holloman, and Peter Arnett because Wiener had connived a four-wire radio transmission system from the Iraqi government. And in so doing, he put 24-hour news on the media map forever. The film, says Wiener, is a reasonably accurate reflection of the facts, but in the early stages, it was almost unrecognizable.
They brought in a number of writers that basically threw the journalism out the window. One draft had Ingrid being captured by the Iraqi secret police somewhere in Kuwait, and me having to walk over a swimming pool filled with sharks to prove my loyalty to whatever. But I always thought it would be an interesting film in and of itself to show what goes on behind the scenes and the pressures.
You don't need to cross over a shark tank to have an interesting story.
Right, exactly.
Let's get to the actual events depicted in the film. This is not only a pretty good commercial for CNN, it also is, in truth, the moment the way news is covered changed. And it was all because of a device that no one will have heard of until they see this film called a four-wire. So what was the significance of the four-wire in the story that you told?
Well, the significance was that when the bombing started, the commercial telephone system was knocked out immediately, and the four-wire, which of course ran under the desert, stayed up. And until the main telecommunications building was blown to smithereens 3 days later, we were able, Bernie, John, and Peter, to transmit live to the world. It's amazing that people think they saw these guys, because actually what they were doing is what we're doing right now, radio. There were no images, but even President Bush in his memoirs writes, "I remember watching with Barbara as Bernie stood under the bombs."
That night was so vivid in people's minds, and many of them remember Bernie rambling on about that turkey sandwich.
5 a.m. here in Baghdad. Honestly, don't know what time it is back in the States where you are, but I imagine around this time I would probably be on my desk eating a turkey sandwich on whole wheat.
And we can't assess the damage officially, but none of us here, I am sure, will ever forget this night.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are off the air.
What the hell was I talking about, turkey?
You are making me hungry!
Now, there was a lot of pressure from Washington to pull out of there. First from White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, then from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time, Colin Powell, and finally from President Bush himself. In the movie, we just hear from CNN's Tom Johnson. He was...
Yeah, Tom was the president, and he had gotten a call from George Bush telling Tom to yank us out because he felt that we were in grave peril. No decision was made. But Tom had lost a couple of reporters at the L.A. Times, and Ted Turner took the pressure off his shoulders.
And placed it squarely on yours and your crew.
Exactly.
By leaving the choice up to you, which strikes me from a distance as rather unfair.
I don't think it was unfair. I think it was the right thing to do. It didn't go down exactly the way it's portrayed in the movie. I wanted to leave, but I felt that it would be reprehensible to have people come to Baghdad at my behest and then desert them. But I was frightened to death.
As somebody who's covered conflicts since Vietnam, you're used to making compromises with the American military, with the...
Iraqi military.
With the Iraqi military, with the Iraqi government. And so it was back in 1991. If you hadn't become friendly with the Minister of Information, if you hadn't been willing to play ball on certain things, you might not have had the four-wire that revolutionized television journalism. That, in the opinion of some, was a devil's compromise that CNN had to make. And I wonder, where did you feel that conflict most acutely at the time?
I felt it during the trip to Kuwait.
Let me quickly summarize what happened in Kuwait. You were offered this exclusive trip to Kuwait through the Ministry of Information. You got there. You were supposed to be reporting on the reputed dumping of babies from incubators, and you were there to prove that that was not the case. They took you to one hospital, whisked you away again. You became the story, as it was reported ahead of the fact that you were going to exonerate the Iraqi government, which you didn't do. The whole thing was a big mess. The CNN crew was embarrassed and clearly manipulated, and I think that pretty much sums it up, right?
On the money. On the money. What happened in reality was that when we got back to Baghdad, I said to Najee...
Najee being the Minister of Information.
Well, he was the Undersecretary. Well, look, the hospital story is one thing. Surely we can report what we saw. And he said, Robert, you can report whatever, but I want you to know that if you talk about other things, that in itself will violate the ground rules, which were not my understanding at the time.
Are you telling me that you can only report the hospital story and the hospital story's bullshit?
That's what I'm telling you.
You must have gotten other stuff. You were in Kuwait, for Christ's sake.
We saw amazing stuff. We can talk about it.
Can't talk about it. The parameters have just been re-clarified.
Re-clarified?
We can report the story if we choose, but we lose any chance of a Saddam interview.
And we could get kicked out.
We would never have agreed to those conditions. This is the darkest day in the history of this network.
Don't you think it's ironic that the Iraqis went so far to manipulate you in order to exonerate them, to exculpate them from the charge of dumping babies out of incubators, when it turns out that that story was made up in whole cloth by the Kuwaitis and they never dumped babies out of incubators, as far as anybody can now tell?
That's right. But let me say that in reality, I asked Najee, is this true? And he said, absolutely not. Now, in the movie, Michael asks, is it true? And Najee doesn't answer.
Now, why doesn't he? What would have, how would that have affected the dramatic integrity of that moment for him to have answered what the truth happened to have been in historical terms?
Look, we can get into a, speak for hours on the mysteries of Hollywood.
What do you think you accomplished back in 1991?
Well, on one level, the world became aware of CNN. Because of CNN's newfound clout, Ted Turner was able to open a slew of bureaus around the world. We were able to devote more people and time to covering stories comprehensively. By the same token, there was a downside to what we did for CNN. And that downside was that the guiding philosophy of CNN, which used to be the news is the star, following the Gulf War, CNN became personality driven. Suddenly we found at CNN that we would go, in my perception, live for the sake of live, at the expense of good textured reporting. Fabulous writers like Richard Blystone were no longer paramount. The money and the PR went to those whose live skills were paramount.
Robert Wiener, thank you very much for coming in.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Robert Wiener was the writer of Live from Baghdad, the book, and the principal character in Live from Baghdad, the movie, showing this weekend on HBO.
Filmmaker Michael Moore gained fame with the 1989 movie Roger and Me, a look at the closing of General Motors plants in recession-wracked Flint, Michigan. He was denied an Academy Award nomination for Best Documentary that year, either because the film was too anti-establishment, that's his explanation, or, as it later came out, because it wasn't much of a documentary. In that film, chronology was significantly changed to fit the narrative. OTM producer-at-large Mike Pesca went trolling through Moore's latest documentary, Bowling for Columbine.
In 1999 in Germany, 381 people were killed by guns. In Canada, 165. United Kingdom, 68 people killed by guns. Japan, 39. Of the 11,127 people killed by guns in the U.S. in 1999, 13 were students at Columbine High School, which provided the dark inspiration for Michael Moore's new film about the causes of gun violence in America, Bowling for Columbine. Armed with a rifle he got for opening a bank account and shocking statistics like the ones you just heard, Moore had plenty of fodder, but still, he was not satisfied. To properly emphasize the point that our country is a veritable shooting gallery, Moore embellishes, grandstands, and ignores inconvenient facts. Fine. Fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly, provocateurs gotta provoke. For purposes of this story, a lack of countervailing viewpoints will not be faulted. The use of cliched happy songs over images of war crimes not once but twice will be unremarked upon, as will the point that Michael Moore would have no career if he just called ahead for an appointment. This is a fact check, an accounting of distortions that would give pause to even the most enthusiastic fans of the movie. Michael Moore was unavailable for comment. We start with the story of a 6-year-old boy who shot and killed a 6-year-old girl in Flint, Michigan, the youngest school shooter in history.
Tamarla Owens was the mother of the 6-year-old boy. In order to get food stamps and health care for her children, Tamarla was forced to work as part of the state of Michigan's welfare-to-work program.
Moore uses the tragedy as an indictment of Michigan's welfare-to-work program. What he doesn't tell you is that Owen sold crack, and that she sent her children to live with her 22-year-old brother, even though he sold drugs out of the house and left guns lying around. Tamarla Owens did have to travel a great distance to work 2 jobs at a mall, taking her away from her children for 10 hours a day. And just as we're asking, who could possibly support and even benefit from a system that left a 6-year-old dead at the hands of another 6-year-old, Moore comes up with an answer. Dick Clark. Tamarla worked at Dick Clark's American Bandstand Cafe and Restaurant, and Moore tracks down Dick Clark with a picture of the 6-year-old killed by Tamarla Owen's son. Clark is supposed to feel shame, because he's ogre enough to employ at 50% above minimum wage a former welfare recipient who told the New Yorker magazine that she loved her job. Or, as Michael Moore puts it,
Tamarla did not see him take the gun to school because she was on a state bus to go serve drinks and make fudge for rich people.
American rich people. If they were rich Canadians, Moore might not have a problem. In Bowling for Columbine, Canada is painted as a kind of frosty, violence-free wonderland. Yet Canada, he tells us, is just like America. 13% non-white, a large appetite for violent movies, and even a taste for firearms.
Wow. Canada was one gun-loving, gun-toting, gun-crazy country.
It's true. Canada has 8 million guns for 30 million people. But there, guns don't kill people, and neither do people. The reason they do in America? Moore blames the news media. America, he says, is gripped by fear, fueled by scary TV news where reports of murder have increased by 600%, even as actual murders have dropped by 20%. Moore goes to Windsor, Ontario, right across the river from Detroit, and finds that gun murders are practically unheard of. He's confused, until...
Until I looked up at the TV in the bar and noticed what they watch for their evening news.
It's a report about speed bumps. Scare-free TV, murder-free city.
Night after night, the Canadians weren't being pumped full of fear.
There's only one problem. In Windsor, like much of Canada, they like to watch American TV news. Ted Shaw is the entertainment writer for the Windsor Star.
The two Canadian newscasts get about 40% of the audience. The five American newscasts, as an aggregate, get about 60% of the audience.
Blaming the disparity in gun violence on the news doesn't make nearly as much sense as citing the difference in gun laws. Moore never mentions that 7.5 of the 8 million guns in Canada are rifles or shotguns. Handguns are very hard to come by. Most are smuggled in from America. And we know there are 8 million because they're licensed. A major difference in gun cultures, says Dave Austin, spokesman for the Canadian Firearms Center, a division of their Department of Justice.
In Canada now, to own a firearm, you have to have a license. And every firearm, whether it be a long gun or a handgun, has to be registered. But you cannot have a handgun for self-protection.
Bowling for Columbine ignores these facts. It also uses fake footage, sometimes to great comic effect, and sometimes because it would have been really cool if someone had videotaped a story Michael Moore wants to tell. When a state trooper tells the true tale of a hunter accidentally shot by his dog, we see the videotape of the incident. Here's Michigan Director of Hunter Safety Education, Lieutenant Suzanne Capello, reading from the original report.
Shooter, 39-year-old white male, attempting to put a loaded 308 rifle on large dog for a photograph at deer camp. Dog began jumping around, four rounds discharged, one passing through victim, 50-year-old male, leg.
And so you have no evidence or record of there being any videotape of this?
No.
Not a lie per se, but the effect of the faked footage weakens the credibility of the parts of the film that are true. The strongest scene in the movie happens when Moore shows up at Kmart headquarters with two kids who were shot at Columbine. A PR person, Mary, offers non-answers for a while, and then...
Mary went back upstairs, and 2 hours later, she brought down this guy whose job it is to buy the bullets for Kmart.
Moore instructs one Columbine kid to lift his shirt to show the wounds caused by bullets purchased at Kmart. But the Kmart official leaves, and eventually so do Moore and the kids, a hulking everyman and his human props shut down by the man. The next day they return, and as yet another publicist steps before the microphones, we're ready for more evasiveness. Then the unexpected happens. Kmart caves.
Kmart is phasing out the sale of handgun ammunition. The business plan calls for this to be complete in the continental U.S. within the next 90 days.
To Moore, this announcement is proof that his methods, his shamelessness, and his crusades have affected social change. Yes, it's a drop in the bucket. Yes, Kmart is bankrupt and may no longer exist by the next school shooting. Still, the scene makes you want to cry. And when you think about it, so does the whole rest of the movie. There's so much tragedy in this subject, so much unnecessary loss and bloodshed in the story of America and its relationship with guns. Michael Moore will tell you he has to speak truth to power by any means necessary. The other side of the story is that distortions and deceptions serve to insult the victims and supply those who stand in the way of progress with all the more ammunition, which we already know is available just about everywhere except Kmart. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Coming up, cameras in the jury room and how the cinema handles shrinks.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Rune Arledge died this week. He has been dutifully eulogized as a giant of modern broadcasting, first with ABC Sports, then as president of ABC News. And a giant he was, the creator of Wide World of Sports, Monday Night Football, and the Slow Motion Replay, made no less of a mark on TV news than on TV sports.
He had his early doubters. When Arledge took the ABC News helm in 1977, critics howled that he'd stage the wide world of news. And in fact, he did, investing resources into bureaus, budgets, and most of all, talent, to tap into what he saw as the inherent drama news affords. He turned nightly Iran hostage coverage into Nightline. He lured David Brinkley from NBC, and he lured millions of viewers to ABC's air.
In a decade's time, he transformed a dimly regarded loss leader into a slick and lucrative profit center, which is when his creation began to turn on him and on us. Michael Eisner doesn't count Peabody Awards, he counts earnings. And once the accountants could assign a value to news content, the content quickly became commodified. By the time Arledge was squeezed out in 1997, parts of his empire were already being sold for scrap. There's no way to know what would have become of ABC News had it remained a low-interest item. But it's fair to conclude that when Roone Arledge died Thursday at 71, he had seen the thrill of victory and surely also the agony of defeat.
The award-winning public television program Frontline is trying to go where no camera has gone before, into a room where a jury is deliberating a capital murder case. The defendant, 17-year-old Cedric Harrison, has said yes, so have the potential jurors, and so has Judge Ted Poe of Harrison County, Texas. But District Attorney Charles Rosenthal stands firm with a resounding no.
I am a firm believer that there are certain issues in the everyday life of Americans that should be kept secret. This would be as great a travesty as placing a camera at a polling place to record individuals' votes for their particular preference for any elected official.
Usually the judge determines what may or may not be taped in a proceeding before his court, but since the DA objects, the Texas Court of Appeals will decide whether to let the cameras in. Professor Gerald Treese of the South Texas College of Law in Houston opposes cameras in the jury room. We'll hear from him shortly. But first, Michael Sullivan, Frontline's executive producer for special projects, explains why his program should have fly-on-the-wall status as a jury decides matters of life and death.
The heart of the matter in capital cases we discovered in our years of research on this is the jury. Lawyers who try capital murder cases say picking the jury is the most important thing to do, more important than the trial itself. They tell us that what goes on in the jury room is more important than what goes on in the courtroom. So as we were trying to do a film to reveal the process of capital murder trials in America, we decided that the heart of the matter was the jury and set out to work with people to see how deep an access we could get to this process. And we found a judge who was willing to allow us to do the complete trial, including jury deliberations.
Professor Treese, you've been quoted in several articles basically saying that TV cameras have no place in jury deliberations. What are your arguments?
Well, first of all, let me say that Judge Ted Poe is one of the most respected jurists in all of Texas. Certainly here in Houston, he's well thought of. But what the judge is doing is saying that the public's right to be informed and to be educated is greater than any juror's interest in privacy, even though in a case such as this, you've got the state objecting through the Harris County District Attorney's Office. The bigger problem that I see is the potential for a juror not being able to freely express himself or herself, a juror who is chilled in their expression because of the fact you have a camera there. That type of chilling effect also leads into potential security problems. If a person says certain things which then are recorded, would that lead then to some potential threat against that individual?
Michael Sullivan, with regard to the chilling of jury deliberations and jury speech, a sense of self-consciousness, some jury deliberations have been recorded in the past. What do we know from those?
The best sort of body of evidence is about 30 cases that were filmed by both CBS and ABC during the last 7 or 8 years in Maricopa County, Arizona. The jurors, to a person that were interviewed afterwards, said the cameras had no impact on their behavior. And I think even more importantly, the judges that presided over those cases, the attorneys on both sides in those cases, and the cases that included, I think, 3 first-degree murder trials, not death penalty cases, but first-degree murder trials, said they saw no discernible effect on the jury's behavior from the cameras. The jurors were all saying, listen, I noticed the camera the first 5 minutes I was in the jury room, and after that we got down to business.
So on that issue, Professor Treese, does that anecdotal evidence persuade you at all?
First of all, I'm easy to persuade because I've always liked the idea of public access to public activity. But in a situation such as this, I'm still very much concerned that we're getting involved into a situation without any standards, without any guidelines to help us determine the interest of the jurors, whether or not those jurors' rights are being protected and whether or not the process is being protected.
Your listeners should understand that there's an elaborate questionnaire that is given to all the jurors in this case in which they are informed about the filming. They're asked many questions about it. The judge has talked to them in open court about any reservations they have. Of the original panel of 110 jurors in the case of Cedric Harrison, 14 said they would be made uncomfortable by the filming, and they were all excused from service. So I think the judge, in fact, has gone out of his way to protect the privacy of any juror who has a problem with this. I do not think that's an issue in this case.
Aren't we supposed to have a jury pool that up to this moment has never had to answer that question? Why should those people be eliminated from the process in determining guilt, innocence in a capital case, and then perhaps the ultimate issue in Texas, life or death? Our problem is going to even go deeper. It's probably the best issue on appeal concerning either the conviction in a capital case or the life or death punishment.
And the point you raise is an interesting one. Are we looking at some sort of public TV form of the Heisenberg principle here? Are you changing the complexion or the character of the jury pool by dint of having those cameras in there and allowing people to opt out because of them? Michael Sullivan?
Well, no one knows in which direction that is. No one knows, you know, what the other points of view of those jurors were. It'd be very interesting to find out. Here's the hard part. Everybody is speculating about what's going to happen here, and everyone's speculation comes from their own sense of the world. The big thing listeners ought to do is ask themselves, what would they do under these circumstances? Would they really not speak out? Would they really grandstand for the cameras? I don't think that's what normal people do.
Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Sullivan is executive producer of special projects for PBS's Frontline, and he joined us from the WGBH studios in Boston. Professor Gerald Treese is from South Texas College of Law, and he joined us on the line from his home in Houston.
This weekend, the sequel to the comedy Analyze This opens nationwide. It's called Analyze That, and it continues the saga of a psychiatrist played by Billy Crystal treating mob boss Robert De Niro. Anyway, it got OTM's Sarah Fischko to thinking.
I asked Dr. Erwin Hirsch, a PhD psychologist and psychoanalyst, the question I've always wanted to ask a shrink. When you see a portrayal of an analyst in the movies, well, how does it make you feel?
I hate seeing portrayals. I could practically never remember an analyst portrayed in any way that I wasn't annoyed, angered by in any medium.
Analysts, it turns out, really do look at these movies.
I think that analysts are concerned about how they're portrayed, not so much having to do with just that they're analysts, but that psychoanalysis has taken a real downturn in the last couple of decades.
Dr. Gail Saltz is chairman of public information at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute.
And I think that they're trying to understand why that's happened, and certainly that has something to do with their image.
Analysts are portrayed almost invariably as powerful. The power to change people, the power to extract secrets from their patients, the power to recover memories for good or ill.
Try remembering. Let your mind go back to your childhood. Was it happy?
Ingrid Bergman, treating Gregory Peck in Spellbound.
I'm haunted, but I can't see by what.
Can't have been too bad for the image of analysis, back in the days when the Europeans in Hollywood were all on the couch. Spellbound even used David O. Selznick's real-life analyst as a consultant on analytic matters. Not that it helped much.
And if we can unlock one tiny memory, it'll give us a key to the others.
That's in the tradition of the
cathartic cure.
Dr. Glenn Gabbard is a professor of psychiatry at Baylor College of Medicine and co-author of Psychiatry in the Cinema. His book lists more than 400 films which involve some form of mental health treatment.
My hand hurts.
Your hand is remembering. Open your mind and the pain will leave.
Gregory Peck suddenly has his flashback to a repressed memory.
It's burning. My hands hurt.
Try to
and he's miraculously cured.
Pretty dramatic for an analytic session.
If you actually put a video camera in my office or any other therapist's office, it would be so boring that people would demand their money back. Nothing exciting happens, generally, in a therapist's office.
If only it could be the way it is in the movies.
How do you know she's willing to be psychoanalyzed?
Oh, she will if I ask her to.
Fred Astaire analyzing, sort of, Ginger Rogers in Carefree.
Well, you do know that you have two minds, the conscious and the subconscious.
Really?
It works all the time, even when you sleep. It never forgets anything.
Is that so?
Then dancing together at the country club. What could a 1938 movie audience have made of that? In that era, the power, perhaps, to lift one out of the doldrums with a little analysis, a little dancing, meant a lot. In more recent times, the power of the analyst has been viewed with wild ambivalence. We like to see them godlike, we like to see them tender, and we like to see them mean. And talk about power, sometimes the image is so striking it affects analysis off-screen.
Scared.
Feelings are scary.
Someone will come in, like After Ordinary People in 1980.
And if you can't feel pain, then you're not going to feel anything else either.
And in this case, it was a college student who was in her early 20s, and she said, I was wondering if you can hug me like Judd Hirsch hugged Timothy Hutton in Ordinary People.
You're here and you're alive.
And I said, well, now, no, we have to use words here. This is psychotherapy. And she said, I know it's just a movie, but the point is it helped him.
I don't know what I would have done if you hadn't been here. You're really my friend?
I am. Count on it.
I guess it helped Nick Nolte, too, to run into Barbara Streisand in Prince of Tide.
You can do it. You can handle it.
While she's analyzing his sister, she winds up expressing more than doctorly love towards him.
Please take me with you.
Prince of Tides was definitely a time when I heard a lot of patients talking about this.
Dr. Gail Saltz.
Is it okay to do that, or is it not okay to do that? Or I found that very disturbing, that analysts could be like this.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
Such boundaries are routinely crossed in the movies, as they are in Good Will Hunting.
Do you buy all these books retail, or do you send away for like a shrink kit that comes with all these volumes included?
Do you like books?
When Robin Williams extracts humanity from a tortured Matt Damon in that film, the cathartic cure and the godlike shrink are one.
It's not your fault.
I know.
No, no, you don't. It's not your fault.
It was a statement that this can't work unless I really express a kind of a love for you that your rotten father or mother didn't do. And I express it overtly and palpably by hugging you, by telling you about my personal life, by taking you home with me, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, God. Oh, God, I'm so sorry.
The flip side of being a deity is being completely evil. They're very close to one another, actually. Analysts who explore the mind, that's very frightening for a lot of people, and they are either idolized or devalued, and those aren't very far from one another.
Some analysts are still reeling from Brian De Palma's Dress to Kill, in which Michael Caine played an analyst.
No waiting. Go right in. The doctor will be with you shortly.
Dr. Gabbard considers it to have been a low point for shrinks.
Michael Caine, whenever he got turned on by a woman patient, would dress up as a woman, take out his razor blade, and murder the patient in the elevator, which we think is bad technique.
Which brings us to power personified, the man-eating analyst.
What is your worst memory of childhood?
Death of my father.
Tell me about it and don't lie, or I'll know.
Hannibal Lecter, of course, is the most evil.
You're very frank, Larry.
And then you see some that are sort of hardworking but misguided, like Jeff Bridges and K-Pax.
I don't believe you're from K-Pax. I believe you're as human as I am.
I would say you're in need of a Thorazine drip, Doctor.
I'd say right now we're getting a pretty good variety of positive and negative portrayals.
Caroline, what are you feeling?
A variety of shrinks. That really is all one can ask.
Do you think I was driving him away, Dr. Sobel?
Looking at them, laughing at them, helps us audiences work things out.
I mean, maybe there's still hope.
Well, he did take out a restraining order against you, and I have to be honest, that's usually not a good sign.
So when it comes to analysts in the movies, I can honestly say that...
Time's up.
For On the Media...
Time's up.
I'm Sarah Fishgill.
And we will continue next week when I get back from my vacation.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan and Jamie York, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Natasha Kurganker. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Well, actually, we need to talk to you about that.
Yeah, as of now, Pesca is no longer our producer at large. He's leaving us, moving on to bigger things. But it's hard to let him go. His ideas, his humor, his unique voice have enriched every part of this program. And the fact is, he was at On the Media long before Brooke and I got here.
He's reported stories, emptied his pockets in interviews, filled in as host, penned most of our parodies, and even composed our corporate anthem. There's media all around us, media big and small.
There are media that are hard to kill, like in that movie by Seagal.
Oh yeah, and he did a memorable piece about advertising's abuse of the record scratch sound effect. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, the guy is amazing.
And incredibly well-informed, and a little odd, and extremely persistent. In this piece about bass fishing in the media, and don't even ask, he wore down reluctant sources with terrier-like determination.
There's a bass fishing game here. Have you seen that at all?
I don't like fishing. That's boring.
But what if the video game were to be, you know, twice as exciting as actual fishing? Might that interest you?
No.
What about you? You like fishing?
No, it's too boring.
Well, if I told you that there was a video game which could take the fishing experience and make it really interesting, would you at all be interested in playing?
No.
Yeah, there's a fishing video game around back. You want to play?
Nah.
My treat. I'll pay for it. Give it a whirl.
I think it's a joke.
Mike, we wish you all success in whatever scheme you have cooked up.
We really do. But should you venture back this way? Know that our OTM is your OTM. It's hard to put on a radio show without our favorite mic.
And now back to the rest of us. Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.